Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And today, since it is Wednesday, it's our weekly series of voter roundtables. And for this one, I'm joined by the four women of the Fayoke family in Peachtree Corners, Georgia. Kelly, Chloe, Paige, and Sophia. Hi, all.
Hello.
So what has the conversation been like around your kitchen table?
A lot of arguments. A lot of I'm right and you should hear me because I'm right. But then also we do come to a conclusion that we don't know what we're talking about.
Don't know what you're talking about? What do you mean?
I mean, we're not, we only know what we can speak on our own lives. We don't know how the government should run, I guess, in theory, because we're not politicians.
I got it. Okay. So you know what I should probably do? I should introduce each one of you individually so everyone knows who you are. Who was that just speaking just now?
I'm Chloe. I'm 24.
Okay. Chloe, 24, a recent grad of Indiana University, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, welcome to you. And how about mom, Kelly?
Hi, I'm Kelly. I'm mom. I won't tell you my age. But I work in nonprofit for a company that I previously lived in Indianapolis. I still work for them, but remotely.
Okay. Well, hello to you, mom. And by the way, being a mom of three girls, hats off to you.
Oh, yes.
my own mom's the youngest of four sisters, and every time they get together, they're a force to be reckoned with. So the woman who sits atop all of that. Like, props to you. Okay. So, and then Paige.
Yes, that's me.
Hi, Paige. And you're 20 and a junior at Wellesley College?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. Well, welcome to you. And one more, Sophia.
Hello. I'm 18. I'm a recent high school grad.
Okay. So welcome to all of you. And thank you so much for joining us. Because, you know, we're doing these voter roundtables and we want to hear from Americans across the country. And the suburbs have really been a focus of both of the campaigns, and we wanted to hear about what the kind of conversations were amongst suburban families. So before we get to sort of politics, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourselves? Because first of all, if I might just point out, you're a mixed race family.
Yes. I was an African American. My husband is an immigrant. Actually, he is from Germany. He's been in the States for over 30 years now, but he is obviously Caucasian and met in Indianapolis, 25 years ago now as of August. We've been together 26 years, but married 25. It's been a roller coaster. It's been a ride, I must say, but it's been a great ride. But we've been blessed to have three beautiful daughters. I always say that, you know, I tell my friends that one of the best things I've ever done is obviously get married and become a mom.
Mm-hmm. So Chloe and Paige and Sophia, just jump in here. What has it been like growing up in your family with across races?
I can go first. For me, I never felt in my own family that I was different. I was accepted and loved. My family used to joke that we were a mixture of chocolate and vanilla, so we were caramel. And then when I got to school, it started to be apparent that I was a little bit different. And I noticed that kids themselves would find their own groups related to whatever music they liked or sports and also race. And so for me, I found that it's been not difficult, but it was a little bit more challenging maybe than someone who's mono race, one singular race, to find their own tribe and family and friends and in school and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And Paige, what about you? Do you feel similarly?
I didn't think I really had much of an issue. I think more so in high school because I went to like a really diverse high school and it had a really low Black population, but I really sought after those friendships just because my parents always affirmed like that I was a mixture of my parents, but I think like they also let me know that in the United States, I'm going to be perceived as Black, mm-hmm. and that I'm not going to benefit from my whiteness in the same way that someone else would who is more white passing than I am. So I don't think I ever really felt like I didn't belong anywhere, because I always knew like I had my family and I felt extremely close to them, and like that didn't really cause me to have any issues like that.
Yeah. And Sophia, what about you?
Back when I was younger, like in elementary school, I was one of the only Black kids in my class. So it was a bit lonely back then. But once I moved into middle school and high school, my classes got much more diverse and I didn't really like feel alone as I did.
And if I have this right, Kelly, so you have lived in Peachtree. The family's lived in Peachtree Corners, Georgia for a couple of years. But before that, you were in a suburb in Indiana. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so is it more or less diverse in Peachtree Corners than it was where you lived previously?
Oh, much more.
Okay.
Much more. In the area we lived in Indianapolis, in our specific neighborhood, I think there maybe have been maybe three Black or other non-whites in the neighborhood. Here and obviously in Atlanta, and in Peachtree Corners, I mean, we have a very, very diverse, as a matter of fact, my daughter's high school is probably one of the most diverse schools in Georgia. At least that's what we were told. And we have absolutely had no problems as far as any racial incidents. I was reflecting, talking earlier, that I had probably more incidents with profiling, that sort of thing, in Indianapolis than I've had here. I've not had any instance here. Of course, I've only lived here 2 years. Mm-hmm. But living in Indianapolis, you know, all my life and growing up, you know, there were several incidences where we were profiled, either at malls or driving in certain neighborhoods, just passing through and getting stopped. So, yeah, I have much more enjoyed my time here as far as that's concerned in the South.
Okay. So let me just ask you then, do the four of you, you're all together right now. You're all living together, even I guess because of the pandemic, you're all back together. Okay. And how has that been?
It's been an adjustment. Paige obviously attends Wellesley in Boston. So this is really the first time she's been home. In any extended period of time other than her summer breaks. Obviously, she's always here has been here with us because she was high school. And then Chloe graduated and decided to move with us when we decided to move to Atlanta. But it's been challenging at times because my husband was working from home. He is back in his office now at his current employer. But when we're all together, it got a little
stifling.
I'm saying a little tight at times.
I think the careful choice of words, point taken. So we're talking to you because of we're in the middle of this, or actually in the last stretch of this presidential election. And I think I heard Chloe say at the beginning that there have been some disagreements. So how much do the four of you see eye to eye, or how much do the four of you differ over the state of American politics right now?
For us, no matter what, the foundation is family, love, and faith. And so all those aspects of us, they influence the way we look at the world. So we all have the same understanding of what we'd like to see the world look like, but we all have different ways of going about that. And so with saying that, the disagreements have never been about, I want like everyone to wear the same color and everything chrome. It's just that we all want the world to be a peaceful place. We just have different ways of how that peace will be achieved.
Mm. Oh, and so that's one big theme in these voter roundtables that we've been having, that it seems as if people's desire for this country, there's some area of overlap, but very different means to get there. So let me just ask you, and I'm going to work from top to bottom here. So, Kelly, can I start with you?
Sure.
What do you know how you're going to vote in November?
And I unfortunately, I'm still undecided. And yesterday's debates really has me even more confused, to be honest with you. I've always been a Democrat. And, you know, lately I've kind of questioned, you know, why am I a Democrat? I grew up in a middle class family who always voted Democrat. So I guess it was just kind of, you know, taught to me that, yeah, you're a Democrat. And I never really took the time to think about why am I a Democrat? So with all the things that are happening on both sides of the lane, I'm really questioning, you know, my allegiance and loyalty to the Democrat Party, but not to say that I am going to go Republican. I am kind of in the middle of the road conservative in a lot of aspects. So some things I do relate to as far as the Republicans are concerned. And then there's many things that I relate to as far as the Democrats are concerned. So it's like my ball confusion sometimes, right? You know, especially as of late.
Yeah. So, do you mind if I ask you a little bit more about that? Because Democratic leadership talks about Black women as being the heart of the party, right? So what specifically is confusing you or making you question why you thought or thus far thought you were a Democrat? What specifically about the Democrats is making you question that?
Well, I question the whole coronavirus thing and the pandemic thing has been handled by both parties. But specifically, this last situation where I guess there was the House and the Senate were supposed to vote on a new package to give the small businesses additional money, and they give out the stimulus check. And instead of, you know, trying to meet in the middle and getting some kind of a conclusive decision, they take a break. The Democrats take a break. I believe that's what happened. The Democrats decided to take a little break. And I'm thinking, okay, people still have to eat. They don't get a chance. They don't get a chance to take a break. People still have to pay their bills. They have to pay their mortgages and their rents and their car payments and put food on the table. They don't get a chance to take a break.
Yeah.
And when they did that, something in me said, this is not right.
So actually, Kelly and Chloe and Paige, stand by. And Sophia, I just have to take a really quick break. We'll be back in a minute. We are talking with the Fayok family from Peachtree Corners, Georgia. They're our suburban family in our roundtable today. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Wednesday, so we are having our weekly voter roundtable. And today we are talking to a suburban family from Peachtree Corners, Georgia. Kelly Fayok is the mother of the Fayok clan. She works in the nonprofit sector. Chloe is 24 and a recent graduate of Indiana University. Paige is 20 and a junior at Wellesley College. And Sophia is 18 and a recent high school graduate. And because of the pandemic, they are all together again, at least for the time being. And Kelly, if I can just pick up where we left off, because you were talking about your sort of being confused or maybe questioning certain things. And you talked about the Congress's handling of the stimulus, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so your conclusion was what, though?
My conclusion is that I don't think either party at this point has the the collective heart, or they don't really understand deeply what is really going on in the everyday, day-to-day functions of families who've lost their jobs. Because I think if they did, they would have a sense of urgency to get things passed and pushed through quicker. And, you know, fortunately, I thank God, my husband and I are still gainfully employed, so we have not been affected as some people have. But I just can only imagine, you know, what our lives would be like if we were unemployed and, you know, depending upon, depending upon a stimulus check or some kind of additional assistance from the government just to get by.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I completely understand that keeping track of all that's happened is very confusing. What I'm seeing here, just to lay out some facts, is that you're right about the House ending its session, but the Democrats in the House passed their stimulus bill and then they left, and that bill has since been stalled in the Senate since late May, and apparently maybe very soon. The Treasury Secretary is expected to come to and talk with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi with a counteroffer to the House's $2 trillion new COVID stimulus bill. So we'll see what happens there. But so I'm hearing your concern about the economy and the handling of the economy in COVID, Kelly. Is that right? Is that a fair way of saying that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so let me just jump around here then. Paige, what do you think? How do you see this moment for the country? Do you share your mom's concerns, or what's your view?
I do, but I think right now my issues lie a lot more with systemic racism that is pertinent in this country and the white supremacy that's being upheld within the highest institutions in this country. And I think that permeates all the way through coronavirus. You can see like statistics showing Black and brown people are most vulnerable to contracting coronavirus and dying from coronavirus. And then that spreads into the protests that have happened recently because of police brutality. And I think, I guess going along back to the topic of voting and who I plan on voting for, especially as of last night, I don't think I plan on voting for anyone. And I guess I'm kind of inspired by W.E.B. Du Bois's speech from 1956 called Why I Won't Vote, where he's talking about how these two parties are just one evil party under two different names, and it's still the same exact way today. And so I don't see myself wanting to vote for Joe Biden and Kamala, who both still believe in heavy policing. I consider myself an abolitionist. I would love to see the prison industrial complex abolished. I don't see the purpose of police, or at least the way that the police function right now, or have always functioned. And I don't see myself voting for Trump because he refuses to denounce white supremacy in this country. And so I'm not going to put my name behind two candidates who don't wholeheartedly have my best interest in mind and the best interest of Black Americans in mind. And I think that's kind of what's shaping the way that I see this election.
Was there any candidate in the primaries that you wanted, you felt you could wholeheartedly cast your vote for?
I think someone who more closely aligned with what I wanted was Bernie Sanders, but he just gave up. In both the 2016 election and now, he just kind of gave up. And I think he had a very fair chance of winning. He had a lot of supporters, and I just don't understand why he dropped out so quickly. But yeah, I think I would have voted for Bernie had he been the candidate.
Okay. Oh, and one more question for you. If I'm hearing you correctly, Paige, your concern about systemic racism is one of the things at the core of what you're thinking about. As you just mentioned, we did hear the president of the United States last night refuse to actually disavow white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm wondering is, if that's your core concern, why is that not enough to make – you may not be voting affirmatively for Joe Biden, but at least you would be voting against a man who won't disavow white supremacy.
Well, the way I see it is that I don't really owe my vote to anyone but mm-hmm. myself and but my interests. And we see that voting doesn't really work. And time again, we see the same issues happening over and over again. And my vote still has not mattered. We can't vote out white supremacy. You can't vote out institutional racism. You can't vote out hate. And the way that this country was built and the way that it's supposed to run, it is running effectively, essentially. It is running the way that it was designed. It is running against Black people. It is running against immigrants. It is running solely to prop up white supremacy. And you can see that in every field. So I don't think that, I think that logic behind saying, oh, a vote for anyone but Biden is a vote for Trump. A vote for anyone but Biden is a vote for anyone but Biden. I think I reserve the right in my heart to vote for whoever I think aligns with my interests. And if he wins, he wins. That's based upon whether the Electoral College votes for him and the whether he wins the popular vote. If he doesn't win, he just didn't have enough votes. And I don't think that we should blame third-party voters, and especially blaming Black third-party voters, because also time and time again, Black people show that they come out to elections. And especially in 2012, Black people voted the highest out of any other racial group. So I think that narrative of like blaming the third-party voter is kind of pigeonholing people into picking candidates who they don't fully see as representing their needs and their desires. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's how a democracy should work.
Yeah. Well, Sophia, you've been patiently waiting here. What do you think about what you just heard your sister say?
I'm going to respectfully disagree, Paige. I do feel as if Biden is our only option at this point. I would have voted for Bernie because I do believe in socialism, but like I think the
I don't think Bernie's a socialist though.
Like
he's not a socialist.
He's like socialist ideals. Maybe he's not like a full socialist, but
no, he's much more centrist than I think people portray him out to be. But continue. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yes. Anyway, I would have voted for Bernie, but since he isn't in the race anymore, I mean, it seems like, at least it seems to me that Biden is basically our only option right now.
Tell me more.
I don't know. I just like Paige said that you can vote for third party voters like libertarians or just like Green Party. I don't feel that way. Like I feel like a vote for like a third party is a vote for Trump. Like it'll swing the election in his favor.
So do I take that to mean that you said you are going to vote for Joe Biden?
Yes.
Okay. And Chloe?
I'm honestly undecided as well. I'm going to be honest, I'm probably going to vote for Joe Biden because I am afraid that maybe my own guilt, but I voted third party in the previous election. And every day you hear like, oh, you messed up the election. You swung it in Trump's hands. And although I disagree, I don't think my single vote changed everything. But I do think it's probably just the smarter thing to do right now. But I will say, I'm also concerned that maybe things would be different if Corona didn't happen, but Corona has happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid that if we do a regime change, for lack of a better word, and we get someone in new, will there be more walls that are put up to hinder progress if we don't have a flow of ideas that everyone can agree with. I'm not saying that Trump has that, but maybe a changing presidents right now is not the best thing to do.
Oh, I see. So what's the old phrase about changing horses in the middle of the race or something? Maybe not. Okay, I've just mangled that, but you know what I mean. So is that your concern that could actually, what, set the country further back or
not further
hinder
back,
progress?
But even in more of a tailspin. I mean, not saying that, I'm just afraid, I don't know how people will vote locally in the Senate and the House, however that looks. I'm not sure. We spend so much time talking about Trump and Biden. We haven't really talked about everyone else underneath that I'm afraid, you know, we flip everything again and we'll be more of what happened during the Obama years that he got so little done because people were just arguing all day. And now I think with Trump, I find that things get done because, some things get done because he is so obnoxious about certain things that people are certain to find a solution.
People are certain to find a solution, meaning
whether it's a Democrat will find a Democratic approved solution to a problem, and a Republican will find a Republican solution to a problem, and he'll kind of choose whatever he sees fit that day.
Okay. Okay. So, Kelly, first of all, bravo in raising your daughters, because they are thoughtful and engaging in one really thoughtful conversation. So we need more of that in this country. So bravo. But, you know, when you hear Chloe and Paige and Sophia sort of share their views, do they try to lobby you, any one of them?
No, because they know I'm just as headstrong. So, no. They may try to lobby me to get what they want in other areas, but not so much in politics, I would say. But, you know, we just kind of have always raised our kids, and even in the very beginning, to have freedom of thought. I mean, we didn't try to sway them one way or the other. As much as I would want them to agree with me in certain areas as far as spirituality and things like that, we just come to the conclusion. We're all individual people. I did not produce robots, and we all have our own free will and everything. So, you know, we just give them the opportunity to research and learn and express how they want to express, you know, however that looks.
You most certainly did not raise robots, that's for sure. I want to actually play for all of you, and then we'll get deeper into some of the issues that we're grappling with as a country, but I wanted to just play for all of you a little bit about how the candidates have been talking about the suburbs, right? Where you live. So first of all, let's just listen to President Trump speaking on the South Lawn of the White House. Here he is on July 16th.
The Democrats in D.C. have been and want to, at a much higher level, abolish our beautiful and successful suburbs by placing far-left Washington bureaucrats in charge of local zoning decisions. They're absolutely determined to eliminate single-family zoning, destroy the value of houses and communities already built, just as they have in Minneapolis and other locations that you read about today. Your home will go down in value and crime rates will rapidly rise. Joe Biden and his bosses from the radical left want to significantly multiply what they're doing now. And what will be the end result is you will totally destroy the beautiful suburbs. Suburbia will be no longer as we know it.
President Donald Trump on July 16th. So is this apocalyptic future something that you think is coming to the suburbs?
No, and frankly, I don't really think I care whether or not people decide to flood into the suburbs. I think especially his comments about, well, one, it sounds very close to redlining to me. I mean, when you think about the history of suburbs, they were made as a safe haven to get away from lower income Black and brown people. So for him to think of upholding suburbia, to me, again, is, like I said before, is upholding white supremacy and upholding
sort of like Make America Great Again, like uphold the previous.
Yeah, values. White picket fence view, like beliefs. And I like, what about someone who lives in an apartment is going to devalue your home? What about them denotes higher crime rates or higher crime activity? These areas are more policed. And so obviously, like, that makes it seem as though they have super high crime rates. But why do people who live in apartments or people who are lower income not deserve the same quality of life and the same sorts of joys and luxuries that people of higher incomes have? And that to me is something that doesn't make sense, but...
So, Kelly, can I just turn back to you here for a second? Because you had said earlier that, especially when you were living outside of Indianapolis, right, that you felt you had been profiled.
Yes.
Just by virtue of being a Black woman, right? And quite frankly, when the president says, zoning, abolishing the suburbs, et cetera, I mean, to Paige's point, he is talking about efforts, historic federal efforts to integrate suburbs, right? To make housing more accessible to all Americans. So in a sense, he's talking, he's fear-mongering about people like you, if I can just be direct. So, I mean, how does that land with you?
It ticks me off personally. I mean, I just, it's ridiculous. We were apartment dwellers for several years before, you know, when my husband and I first got married, and then we had Chloe. We lived in an apartment for a short time, and I don't consider myself a criminal or someone, who would be a person you wouldn't want to be neighbors with. So yes, I take great offense to that. And it goes back to what Paige said, is that redlining. You know, my parents experienced redlining back in the 50s and 60s when they were, looking for a home. And it just, it perpetuates again that white superiority mentality. And this is ridiculous. And especially in this day and age that we live in. And, it infuriates me. And when he does these things, he incites, these younger mob groups that want to go and have the rallies against the Black Lives Matters and things like that. And he just incites so much ignorance and so much hate. Mm-hmm. I hate to say this, but I don't even recognize part of this country anymore.
Yeah. Kelly, hang on here for just a moment. Kelly, Chloe, Paige, and Sophia are members of the Fayok family. They live in Peachtree Corners, Georgia, a suburb of Atlanta, and they are our photo roundtable today. We just got to take another quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Wednesday, and it is our weekly voter roundtable. Next week, we'll be doing it again, and we are going to be talking with younger voters, specifically people who turned 18 in just the past couple of years and will be casting their first presidential ballot in November. So if that's you, how do you feel about voting for president for the first time in this election in 2020? What do you make of the political system of this country that now you're fully enfranchised and participating in as a voter? What do you wish older Americans who will be voting would care about? And what's going to determine how you're going to cast your ballot? So share your thoughts at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We're looking for younger voters who recently turned 18 and will be casting their ballots for the first time. Today, we are talking with a family of suburban voters, the Fayok family, Kelly, Chloe, Paige, and Sophia. They live in Peachtree Corners, Georgia. It's a suburb of Atlanta. And ladies, if you could just hang on here for a second, I want to play some tape because we also spoke with a Georgian who is going to be voting for President Donald Trump. Because, of course, in fact, Democrats think that Georgia may be in play for them this year because of the female suburban vote around Atlanta. But Sarah Bolt, who about a year ago moved from the suburb of Lilburn to a more rural area, she thinks the Atlanta suburbs are still full of women who will vote for President Trump.
I think that there's a lot more of them than you think. If we grew up in the South and we were raised by conservative parents, we don't even usually talk about politics in a public setting because religion and politics are the two things that you don't discuss in polite company. That was the way I was raised. I mean, that was the saying. And so I think you're going to find that there are far more suburban moms that are going to vote Trump. And they're just not talking about it because they don't want to hear about it at Starbucks. They don't want to hear about it in their mommy group. They don't want to hear about it. Or they're afraid of harming relationships that they value with people that might disagree with them politically, you know, so they just choose not to discuss it.
And Sarah also told us that she voted for Donald Trump in 2016, and she's planning to vote for him again.
I give him a lot of leeway because he is from New York, and New Yorkers speak their mind, and they don't care whose feelings they hurt. Politics is politics, and people will slander each other, and they will bring up every worst possible thing that they've done. And so I ignore all of that because that's just standard operating procedure. The days of truly civil discourse in politics is either very far in the past or very far in the future.
That's Sarah Bolt from Georgia. I want to know what the four of you think about that. And Chloe, let me start with you. When Sarah says the days of civil discourse in politics is either far away in the past or very far in the future.
I think she's correct in saying that obviously it's not happening right now. And I believe it's because of how we talk on the internet that's truly responsible, because Donald Trump wouldn't say really these things if he didn't get tons of retweets on his almost psychotic tweets, like at 3 a.m. And so he can say these kinds of things because his followers are just like, wow, I can't believe someone, like she said, you know, someone's speaking their mind. And I disagree. I don't think you should be as gruff as he is. I mean, especially last night when he talked about Biden's children. I know he doesn't particularly care if people talk about his children because either he's super proud of them or he just generally doesn't care about anyone but himself. But Biden obviously cares about his children. And I think he was hurt. You could see kind of the steam go out of him a little bit when he started talking about his children, and it got him flustered. And so I think it was a low blow, but she's right. I mean, I know people in our neighborhood who are going to vote for Trump. They have the stickers. So people in the suburbs still like him, but I think a lot of people are just tired of him and they'll just turn over to Biden. They might not vote Democrat all the time, but they're just tired of Trump and his antics.
Sophia, you've been quietly listening in for a while. What do you think?
I think Chloe's right in that people are tired and they probably will vote for Biden because of that. But there aren't very many kids my age in this neighborhood. So like, I don't really like talk to anyone that much. So I don't know like many people like who live around it, thus their political opinions. So Chloe said the majority of the information I get is from the internet. So like I have a pretty democratic feed. So.
And so why did you want to point that out?
Because he was just saying that you get a lot of your information from the internet, and it basically like she was saying like Trump is just saying like all these like really outlandish things.
Okay. So let me ask the four of you, I mean, this, you know, in public radio, we talk all the time when we do these round tables of trying to simulate like talking at a kitchen table. And the four of you are literally the closest I've ever come to actually being sitting at a kitchen table with a family thinking through the big issues of the day. So just, you know, feel free to talk with each other, but I am really curious to hear, like, what are your hopes and dreams for your family, for each other, for the next 4 years?
Well, coming from a mom's point of view, I want my children to have equal opportunity as anyone else who walks this planet. I want them to have opportunities to advance in their careers. I want them to even have careers, to be able to be in the field that they choose, or the career choice they choose, and actually have a opportunity to have a job in that particular field. I want them to have access to excellent health care, and it not cost them an arm and a leg as far as deductibles and co-pays are concerned. That's basically, yeah. I mean, I want them to be able to live where they want to live at and play and grow and do what they want to do. And I want them to be just healthy, good American citizens.
Mm-hmm. What about the rest of you? I'm going to think that your actual kitchen table conversations are maybe more more boisterous than what we're hearing now. So let it rip, guys. Go ahead.
Let's go ahead.
I guess could you repeat the question a little bit? Just so
what do
you
dream
for
our
family? You dream, yeah, for yourself, our family.
I guess from my family's perspective, like I would like to be, like I would like to see my family continue to like live comfortably and like see my sisters become successful in like whatever career field they choose, and like I want to be able to graduate college. I actually want to be able to step foot on my college campus. That's one thing. Before I graduate, I want to be able to step foot on my college campus. I guess, yeah, I want to, more personally, I guess, like my political views, I definitely don't think they align with a lot of peace and like harmony, but I would like to see that, I guess, later on.
Oh, you say that, but do you, do you want these small businesses to keep being destroyed? These small, like, these immigrant families that have spent all their entire life savings for a convenience shop to just be destroyed in a riot?
No, but I don't think hurting small businesses is the way to go about it. I don't see why we don't go after these big multinational corporations. Yes, we do not care.
How would we do that, though?
Like, bang on the doors?
These companies are responsible, one, for the like the downfall of the environment.
Okay, right, but what would we do? Sign a petition? That does nothing.
It doesn't. But I think there needs to be a revolution. I just don't see any other option besides revolution. And obviously, like, I am not a political theorist. I am not staunched in leftist theory to where I could answer exactly what I think that would look like and to what mediums you'd go about doing that. But I don't see how you could look around and not see that there's a need for revolution or change, because the way that we've been going about things is not really going to come up with these. I just don't see, like, that stupid thing in the New York on Wall Street about like the 7 years to like environmental disaster. Like, do I even have 7 years to like go to college and like fulfill whatever career goal that I have or dreams?
Well, no one has the answers. That's not.
So that's why, like, to me, I would rather see change that I know will like prevent those sorts of disasters, or like that will change the course.
Well, one, we have to address that when it comes to the environment, America actually does good stuff most of the time. Especially talking about suburbia, since 10 years ago, we've always had a recycling bin in our neighborhood. We've always had a recycling program.
But it's not. Everyone's always. It is on the individual consumer, but it's also on these big corporations.
But it's also on these third world countries that are developing. They're the ones who have all the toxic waste.
Because they've been. No.
Yes.
No. That is so. It is.
If you want to
these
more
companies need to be more responsible. No, I don't believe in sending troops anywhere, honestly. Because that's been the downfall of a lot of these countries. It has been the fight for oil that has been the downfall of a lot of foreign countries.
And I agree.
But
if you look at America, I mean, there's so many people in our neighborhood that have electric cars, chargeable thingies
everywhere.
That's
not what I'm talking about.
But I'm saying
the individual person can do all that they can.
But it's not America's fault. Yeah. And that's what I'm talking about.
I'm just saying, but these businesses are, there is nothing, there's no Green New Deal. There's nothing being.
Which Biden already said is not going to happen. So
that's what I'm saying. Why would I vote for either of them if neither of them plan on caring about the environment? And
Green New Deal would raise taxes like crazy. Mom and Dad already complain so much about how much they pay in taxes. They don't see what they work for. Why do you want to raise taxes?
How about if we defunded the police and allocated that money to other places? The taxes wouldn't have to be raised.
Well, you can't defund the police. I mean, there are many good police officers out there. You can't just
because
you got to.
We have a way of life, and that the police are a part of that in some way, shape, or form. You're never going to get rid of them. They have a purpose. If you get.
Your purpose used to be slave patrols, and that's still kind of.
Okay,
but the thing is that everything else
the 1860s
evolved,
page.
That we evolved. And yeah, I don't understand, like, why you don't.
Evolved with the same sort of white supremacy.
Yes,
we're in 2020 where most police officers now, they're just dudes who just like wearing the uniform, to be honest. They're like not guns. Like, they're not going into the job every day like, hey, I'm gonna kill a black person. That's never.
But, I mean, some of them do, obviously. Yeah,
I don't care. I don't think anybody wakes up.
Yeah, no one wakes up like that, and that's where
wakes up thinking that, you know, hey, today's the day I'm going to kill me a black person. I don't think anybody has that on their agenda. And I think things get escalated. Yes, and they have, and maybe sometimes they have their own personal biases in how they address people of color when they are accosting them, that kind of thing. But I cannot believe that in humanity we are that sick that someone would wake up and say, I'm going to go out and kill a black person, using my badge as an excuse to be able to do that.
And that happens all the time, where people use their badge as an excuse for excessive violence, or they use it to protect
badge immunity. But yeah, whatever you suggest, self-policing or whatever.
No, I think that's not working either, because everyone's foreign. But no, that's what I'm saying. I don't have all the answers. There are people who have written about this extensively who can answer it
they're all theories.
So, ladies, I don't want to step in to this because the conversation that you're having right now is the conversation that I think is happening in homes across the country, right? The only reason I'm stepping in is because I'm looking at a clock that says we have 3 minutes left. But you are reflecting all of the issues and all of the perspectives that are roiling this country right now. And I am incredibly grateful for letting me listen into this. Because I think the fact that you can all three of you can talk together about this, I'm constantly seeking for hope. Like every show, I'm like, okay, what is the thing that I hold on to that's hopeful? And this is it, that we can still talk with each other just the way that you did. Obviously, there was disagreement there, but also love. So I have 2 minutes left with the four of you. And I had asked you earlier about what are your hopes for each other as a family. So I'm going to ask you in the next 2 minutes to share with me what your hopes are for this country, for your country, for the next 4 years. Because ultimately, when people cast a ballot, if they do in every presidential election, part of what they're doing is they're saying, this is what I want for my country. So in just like a minute or two, could the four of you quickly tell me what are your hopes for America for the next 4 years?
Yeah, my hope is that we can see each other as humans and without looking at color first, without looking at class, that sort of thing. That's just my hope.
My hope is for smaller government, less government intervening in our personal lives, lower taxes, and that we all do respect each other as humans.
I want to see equitable access to healthcare, the dismantling of white supremacy. I just want to see like some form of change because frankly, it's getting pretty tiring just like having these conversations. We don't want to keep having them.
You don't want to keep having them.
Yeah. We don't need the arguments, the headaches.
Yeah.
I think America doesn't need the arguments and the headaches for much longer. Yeah. Well, Kelly Fayok, is the mom of this wonderful family. She works in the nonprofit sector. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also, I mean, as from one fellow mom to another, good job. Okay. Keep it up. These girls are amazing. Chloe, oldest sister, 24, recent graduate of Indiana University. Chloe, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Paige, 20 years old, a junior at Wellesley College. Paige, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Sophia, 18 years old and a recent graduate of Duluth High School. Sophia, thank you so very much. Well, we're going to come back next week with another version of our weekly voter roundtable. As I said earlier, we're going to be talking with young voters who are casting their ballots in a presidential election for the first time. If that's you, call us at 617-353-0683. What are your hopes for this country when you cast that ballot? Again, 617-353-0683. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.